All right, so it gives me great pleasure to announce our speaker for this evening. I met this gal a couple of years ago when I was having some difficulty coming in and out of here, and I just love her to death. So let's welcome her to the podium, Yolanda.
All right.
Yeah.
Tom gave this to me tonight. That's really sweet. So bunny goes there, water goes here, my books go here. And, you know, I just feel like saying what he said. Thank you. You know, because I'm in agreement with him about being out of ourselves when we're here and, you know, it not being about us. And hopefully that, I'm hoping my higher power speaks through me what it is that somebody in here needs to hear, because my experience with my higher power is that, you know, the message, he gives the message, you know, we hear it when it's time, when he wants us to hear it, you know. And I want to start just real quick. Tina might have done this last week, but I planned to do it before that. I want to start with a prayer because I just need to do this. And I want to do the 11th step prayer because that says so much. Lord, make me a child. And you can sing. You can say it with me also if you'd like. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love. That where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness. That where there is discord, I may bring harmony. That where there is error, I may bring truth. That where there is doubt, I may bring faith. That where there is despair, I may bring hope. That where there are shadows, I may bring light. That where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. And I know that's kind of jumping ahead, and that, you know, it's comes down here, but it's covered down here. But I was looking for all this stuff in the beginning. You know, I was looking for all this in the beginning, and I couldn't understand. I mean, I grew up, my grandmother take me to church and stuff. Service was in Latin. I didn't know what was being said, but I knew it was important for me to be there. And I thought I knew God. I thought I knew all there was to know about him, but I didn't understand why he wasn't answering me when I would get into these emotional drama periods and just, God, come on, and I'd be so, you know, so pathetically dramatic and everything, and oh, he doesn't work, you know. And but now today I get it. I get it. You know, I was, the sixth. My mom had 7 kids. I was number 6. Out of the 7, and by the time I was 6 months old, her husband had just deserted her, and so she was left to raise all of his kids. My mom had a lot of pride. There was no way she was going to sit home and do welfare and stuff like that, so pretty soon on, I think after I was in kindergarten, she went to go seek employment. She had no skills. She had nothing. And I remember being on the bus with her, you know, going here and going there, and, you know, they didn't have the internet at the time. You had to actually go and apply at the company, you know. And so I can remember her, you know, following her here and there to go apply for jobs, and she finally did get a job, and it was a good thing for her, but it meant that we were home, you know, all these kids, and that's a big mess, you know, no adult supervision, no nothing. We were what you called latchkey kids. You know, we got ready for school, got to school and everything, and when we would come home, you know, we had the key to the front door, and, you know, we'd enter the house, close the door, and all chaos happened. And, but by the time she got home, we were like, we put it together. You know, the dinner was on the stove, one sister had dinner going, you know, the other one was making tortillas, and, you know, and we grew up in the projects in Pacoima. You know, and that, well, I don't know if anybody knows what Pacoima is, but yeah, that was a project, you know, and so she was doing everything she could to get us out of there. You know, with the absence of your parents, you know, kids are going to, like I already mentioned or alluded to, kids are going to get crazy and do things, and there was a lot of unpleasant stuff that happened in the home. And then my mom met this other guy, you know, and so he starts coming around the house and stuff. And I remember in the utility room seeing, I don't know if you guys remember, Burgermeister. It was like a, you know, the guy had like some kind of helmet on or something. And I remember going in the utility room and always seeing those brown bottles with the Burgermeister. And I didn't get it, you know. But he would, you know, come over all the time. And he didn't live there, but he would come over. Then my mom had number 7, which was his daughter. And so that was more responsibility, you know. But she was trying to make it work. And you know, I'm gonna touch on this because it's really important, because it's what kept me shut down. It's what kept me locked up. But there was incest in my home, okay? And it started when I was at the age of 2. And so it continued until I think I was 10 or something like that. And so when you're raised like that and you have a really, really angry older brother and stern, and you're told, don't cry, don't do this, do that, don't do this, and don't talk, you know. And when you're raised like that, it's pretty messed up, you know. It does an emotional number on you. And the worst thing it did, I think, is that it didn't, I couldn't talk, and I didn't know what my feelings were. I didn't know emotions. I was just a bottled mess. And as I got older, you know, I went into middle school, I just kind of gravitated toward the wrong, you know, the kids that were less desirable, would you say? You know, I mean, the crowd, rather. And so we would drink. I would go to the local liquor store, and the local wino would come around, and we'd have our, you know, quarters and stuff together, and we'd have him buy us the liquor, and he'd come out and give us a bottle. We bought Gilby's gin because it was so cheap, you know. It was cheap, but that's what we could afford. And, you know, I would spend the night at my girlfriend's house, and, you know, that was in middle school. And we'd just be drinking and stuff, and the guys would come over, and we'd hang out. We'd go cruising and stuff. And, you know, my mom didn't know any of this was going on. No, she didn't know anything. But that's all I knew about hanging out. I didn't know there was a different way. It was all about, you know, let's get drunk, let's get drunk, let's get drunk. And that's what we proceeded to do. And if my mom caught on, she didn't let on, you know. And so then I go to high school, and I'm doing the same thing. You know, we left Pacoima, went to another community, and I was, I think, 11th grade, and it was a culture shock. It was, then immediately there I went, you know, starting to gravitate toward the kids, you know, the children of the lesser God. That's what it felt like, you know. But anyways, excuse me. So, and we would drink, and the kids would come over, to my parents would go to work, you know, and by then my mom's boyfriend moved in. They established this household together when there were 2 of us left to raise. And so, you know, I didn't like school. I always sat at the back. I hated homework. I just barely, you know, slid through the classes, you know, as far as the grades and stuff like that. I wasn't a book, I was just a crappy student, but I made enough to get, you know, go to the next grade. And so I'm hanging out with these friends, and we're going to the store in the morning, and we're getting Ripple, and we're drinking, and we're going to first period late, you know, surprise, you know, I flunked first period because I'm never there, you know, so comes time to graduate. I can't graduate because I'm missing 2 credits, 2 classes, you know, 10 credits at that time. And I couldn't graduate. So I proceeded to go to West Valley Occupational Center, which is in Woodland Hills, and I was able to take the bus there. But after a couple weeks of that, it was just suck because it was just took all day to get there and this and that. So then I get a phone call one day. I'm at home, and my brother calls me, and he says, "Hey," he says, "Dad's back." And I go, "What?" I never met the man. He left when I was 6 months. I'm like, "What? Dad's back? Okay." So I wanted to meet this man, so I go to Las Vegas. That's where he lived, and two older brothers and myself, we went there to go live with him. And he's alcoholic. and he's drinking. He goes on benders at a, you know, benders for days at a time, and he's got his guitar and he's got his vodka and cucumber slices, and that's all he's existing on for like 2-3 days at a time. And then I get my first job, and so I come home and I give him the money, you know, and my brothers are giving him their part of the rent. And next thing we know, we're being evicted because this guy's got a gambling problem, so, which is why he lives in Vegas. And so we have to move. So we did move, and things just got really, really bad. And I needed to go back home, and so I went back home, and my brothers eventually left because they, you know, it just wasn't working out. And I come back home, and I just started picking up again, started hanging around with the same old friends, you know, telling my mom, having people meet me on the corner, telling my, someone come to the door, I'm going out with so-and-so, and then they drop me off with the other in the other neighborhood, and then I'm running around with those kids, you know, in the less affluent area, or whatever you want to call it, you know. And I'm just not really living life. I'm just hanging out just to drink and drink and drink. And again, my parents, if they knew I was drinking, nothing was said, you know. And so then I meet Lou. I was 18 when I met Lou, and we proceeded to drink together because I'm in a relationship now, and I can't be me in a relationship. You're not going to like me if you see me sober in a relationship. I have to get drunk so that I could be comfortable being around you and comfortable for you, knowing who I am. And so we proceeded to drink together, and you know, I had a lot of, just so many, you know, we had a good time. I mean, drinking was fun in the beginning. It was. We had a good time and this and that, but it got to the point. I don't know when we crossed the line, but I know that we did. And, you know, we just spent a lot of years drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking. Everything. We did a lot of camping, a lot of fishing, a lot of outdoor stuff, because that's what you do. You drink. You say you're fishing, but you're really just hoping you don't get a bite because it's going to mess up with your, you know, with your beer and stuff like that. And so that's what we're doing. And, you know, and then finally, it's just not coming to me right now that, you know, but finally we get married, and the weekend that our invitations are being printed, he really pulled a bender. Lou really pulled a bender, and I really wanted to know. I was really thinking, oh, I don't know if I'm going to marry this guy, but I'm going to go through with it because the invitations are already getting, you know, done and everything, and just didn't have the courage to make that kind of decision, so we just went ahead and we got married anyway. And I didn't see the alcoholism in him for what it was. See, because Lou was always getting in trouble. Lou was flipping vans, flipping cars. Lou was ending up in jail, getting in accidents. And, you know, my first car accident was with him, and it wasn't our fault, but because we had open containers, we were automatically, you know. So just that kind of stuff, hanging around with Lou all the time, you know. And the truth is that I was just as alcoholic as he was, as much alcoholic as he was, but I never got caught. People were always letting me slide, always letting me slide. And when he got sober, I remember got sober at Glendale Memorial Hospital. And I remember going there to visit him one time, and the guy said, okay, well, you know, he's sober now, and that doesn't mean that you should walk on eggshells. You know, you go ahead and you do whatever you're doing. He's got his program. He's going to work his program. And I'm like, yes, I can finally, you know, drink and not worry about him. Because I was the Al-Anon at the same time, coming home from work and not doing anything with my friends or anything because I needed to know where he was. I needed to make sure he wasn't in trouble. I was drunk driving. And if he wasn't home, I'm out there looking for him. And So then again, like I said, he gets sober, and then I'm not walking on eggshells, but I'm really mindful about, you know, wanting him to be successful in his sobriety. And I started finding, I remember when I found, see, I wasn't the alcoholic because I never got caught. I was always, I worked in San Fernando and I lived in Moore Park and I'm taking the 118 freeway and I'm waking up, you know, Friday night I'm going to happy hour with the girls at work, and then I'm waking up Saturday not knowing which route I took home. It could either be the Santa Susana Pass or the 118. And I don't know how I got home, but I didn't get caught, so I'm not having a problem. Society is not telling me that, hey, you're creating havoc out here and stuff like that. Nothing is happening like that. I'm getting pulled over, but getting away with it. I'm not losing my job. My husband's not going anywhere. I had no consequences for how I drank, and I was constantly driving home in a blackout that just amazes me how I didn't get in an accident or anything like that. And then I'm going to church, you know, and I know something's wrong though. Okay, I'm not getting caught, but I know something's wrong. I'm irritable and you know, discontent. And I know something's terribly wrong, but I can't put my finger on it. But I'm not alcoholic because I'm not getting caught. I'm managing to keep, you know, my job and all this stuff, you know, and then I started to, I was told that I should start going to Al-Anon. So I thought, okay, let me do this thing called Al-Anon. I was so pissed of having to go because I didn't have a problem. I'm having to go because it's recommended for him. So I'm going to do it. And I start going there, and then I thought, well, maybe I could find some women to drink with. But they're not. Nobody's suggesting it. Nobody's recommending it after a meeting or anything like that. And so I'm not going to bring it up, you know. So I just kind of, you know, just take it easy on that. And then I started to, you know, then I started to hang around with Lou and going to the AA functions that he was going to. And I could remember his first dance that he went to, his first sober dance. And I wasn't going to have anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. Heck no, that's not my thing. That's your disease. You know, look at all the records you created. And, he said, well, I'm going to go to this dance. You know, I just need a ride, but I'll get a ride back home, you know. And so I said, okay. So I went and I dropped him off. And I go home, and it's 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and I'm fuming. I'm the Al-Anon, right, looking up for the alcoholic, and I'm fuming. And he comes home, and I was so mad. And I said, you just remember, you're sober. You're not single. You're sober. Don't get them confused, you know. And I was angry because he had places to go, people to see, and he was having a good, he was happy. And I was so angry, and I wanted to hurt him, and I wanted him to hurt as much as angry as I was, you know. And he's like, well, I says, you know, what's going on? And I go, going on and on, and I'm like, and another thing, and I'm really going to get him this time, I want a divorce. And then he stands there and he says, well, my sponsor told me not to make any big decisions in the first year. And I'm like, there went that, you know. So I just couldn't get him, you know. But that's how sick I was inside, you know. I was just, I started to find, you know, during house cleaning on Saturday when he would be at work overtime, there were a couple times, well, the first time it happened, I was really taken back, and I was found empty containers under the sink, and I'm like, you know, and they were mine. They were mine. And before that, I remember going out to, like, the Christmas dinners and stuff from where I used to work and having to get drunk before going out to get drunk. You know, I'd have the slow gin or whatever it was. I had slow gin one time, and that was so slow, I couldn't get where I needed to be right there. So, you know, that didn't do that again, you know. But I would have to get drunk before going out to get drunk. And by then, he's sober, you know. And he's not saying anything. He's not interfering with my drinking. And so then I thought, okay, well, let me go with them to this Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went to a couple meetings, and it still wasn't quite for me, but I heard something. I had to go out. I did another happy hour with the girls, and it kind of ruined it for me, you know. And I really paid attention this time. And that's part of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, because, I went out one more time to drink. But then the next couple days after that, I felt the, and I was never aware of this before, I felt the depression. I was depressed for a couple days, and I never felt that before. I had no idea that alcohol could do that, you know, could bring on that kind of feeling. And it got my attention. And then you know, then I thought, okay, well, maybe there's something to this. Well, so I started going to the AA meetings, but women's meetings first, because men scared me, because remember my history with all that crap, you know, and all that stuff. And I was just so intimidated by men. I just was so uncomfortable. And thank God for those women's meetings. And I would go there. But I couldn't talk. Again, even in the meetings, I'm in the back. I'm way in the back, you know. And I don't want any attention. I don't want anyone looking at me. And don't make me raise my hand up to say I'm an alcoholic, because I can't. That's too much. I can't do that. I cannot do that. So then I knew I could only hang around there so long without you guys expecting something from me, you know. So I started to, you know, little by little, and then I could finally say Yolanda Alcoholic, but it wouldn't be without a lot of crying. And I don't know how many months it took me till I could finally raise my hand without crying. And I don't know how many years it took me till I could finally sit at the table, not in the half measured area, but at the table, you know. And I remember going to, you know, during this period, well, before that, I can remember going to church and just looking for something, and I wasn't finding it. I don't know what I was looking for, but I wasn't finding it, and I think I had this expression on my face, and even the pastors were kind of like not coming up to me, you know. I was irritable and discontent, and I didn't know, and just, you know, church hopping. Okay, that didn't work. Let's go to this church. Okay, now let's try that. Okay, and I'm just looking for something, and I don't know what it is. And coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm looking for a sponsor, and I go to this one lady, and she says, well, after the meeting, she says, well, call me. So I call her, and she says, well, let's meet for coffee, and let's, you know, talk, and then I'll let you know if I'll sponsor you. That's a bunch of bullshit. I'm sorry. You don't do that. And, you know, I'm a newcomer, and you don't do that, you know. So I have to go meet her at a restaurant, and we're having coffee and stuff like that. And then after that, she says, okay, I'll sponsor you. Well, it was just a couple of weeks after that, I find out she's in real estate. They're having a thing in Las Vegas, and she's going to Vegas with the man who's in her office, and he's married, and they're going to have the affair. And I'm like, what? So I dropped her, you know, and so another sponsor who was too busy, and of course my feelings were hurt because she didn't like me. She said she was too busy, you know, and, you know, sponsor shopping, you can learn a lot, you know, but there's a lot of lessons to be, you know, to be had. And finally I got a sponsor, and things were going really good until she moved to June Lake, and then that, you know, we proceeded to write at each other, and then after that we decided that wouldn't work, so I didn't have a sponsor for a while. And I thought, because I had been to enough meetings and stuff, that I could, that would be all right, you know, I could do this thing, Alcoholics Anonymous, without a sponsor, and it didn't work. And I think that I had some really difficult times in my sobriety early, because I didn't work the program. I mean, I wasn't drinking. I was going to meetings maybe twice a week, but I wasn't really working the program, and some things came to pass that were just, well, it's part of my story, you know. And I had this falling out with my boss at one of my jobs that I had for like 14 years, and and he really made it difficult for me. What happened was he started dating this girl and gave her a big raise, and when I tried to take it to the union, he said he forbade me. You don't tell an alcoholic, I forbid you to fight this, you know. And so that's what I did. I went to the union, and I lost, of course, because management, you know, and this and that. We have a new director in here, and he needs him, and so they're going to let me go, you know, and that's fine. That's what happened. But it really depressed me, so I ended up getting on antidepressants. And I suspect that if I really would have been using this program and stuff, that wouldn't have happened, but it did. And so I'm taking antidepressants now, and I'm not really working the program, and we're having trouble with my son in school, so I get this great idea, and we're going to do geographical. I'm going to retire, you know, so I could be at home with my high school kids, because we had a family late, you know, later, and so we moved to Kentucky, and because you can live for on a lot less in Kentucky, so that's what we did. But before we left, I wanted to say goodbye to some friends, and so I proceeded to go, and I drank again, and so there went my sobriety, and I go to Kentucky, and we get there, and now everything's going to be fine, because we got this handle now. I could be at home with the kids and this and that. And I proceeded to drink even there. And Lou and I ended up separating, and I got my own place. And now everything was going to be just fine because I'm happy now. I've got my own house. The kids are with him, and everything's ideal. You know, this is what I've always wanted, right, to find myself. And I ended up drinking and to capacity. I mean, I could never drink intelligently. It was always, you know, with the intent of getting drunk, with the intent of getting out of who I am. And that went on until I almost ran over a jogger. I would go to my niece's house, and she was alcoholic too, so I loved to hang out there, and so we would just drink and drink and drink until, and I drink until there's nothing there, absolutely till it's gone, and I don't know when to stop, and I can't stop. I just stopped. It doesn't even come into my mind, in my head, you know. It's just like, why, you know? And then I'm on my way home one night, which is just a few blocks away from her, so I justified it. You know, it's not that close, that far. What can happen? And I'm driving home, and it's dark, and there's a jogger, and I almost hit her, and it scared the daylights out of me. So I thought, okay, we're going back to AA. So I went to AA over there, and I'm sitting around the table, and I'm saying, you know, I'm pretty new. Well, I'm not really new to the area. By then, it was 2 years, and I said, and you know, I don't have a sponsor. And before the meeting's over, I've got a woman's number, her name and her number, and she tells me to call her, and I call her, and she was my, you know, I got my first year with her, and then we came back to California. And I'm kind of jumpy. I'm not really getting into the disease, and I'm not really covering the steps because I'm not there yet. I mean, I could pick up the book, and I've picked up this book, and I've read it, and I understand it when I'm reading it, but I put it down, and I forget. It doesn't mean I'm not working the program. It just means that's where my head is at. So I'm going to kind of go, you know. So we come back to California, and I think we're here, what, like maybe 3 years. And really, life isn't that bad. I mean, I can stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous because that's step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves, that's what saved me. Because when I got here, I was so emotionally, I was such a mess, and I didn't know if I didn't know that I was insane. I didn't know I was insane. And I heard a woman say it, and I love this thing. She says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. That, to her, said, it meant, there's nothing short of paradise. That step promises nothing short of paradise. And I thought, oh my God, then, you know, there is hope for me. There is hope for me. So we come here, we come to California, and Lou gets cancer. And I'm like, okay, this is where crap hits the fan. I've had it fairly pretty easy, you know. I can, you know, I'm not really being challenged in this thing called sobriety, this walk with AA, because things are pretty easy. And, you know, is this program going to be able to keep me together if something does really happen? And something did really happen. So he's diagnosed with lung cancer, and so we have to, and we're really scared. This is a whole new, this wasn't what we planned. We were going to retire and do the road trip and this and that. And he has to start going to chemo. And so he does that. And so we go to chemo, and there's Trish. There is Trish getting her chemo treatments, and so Lou would get his chemo treatments, and he would sit right next door to Trish. They'd sit next to each other, and that was really comfortable. I mean, comforting. I guess where I'm going right now is what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for us, you know. And when Lou was on the medication, on the pain medication for the cancer, he was not really easy to be around. It affected him in a very negative way with his mood. And I remember it was on a Saturday that we were fine. We had to go to ICU because he got so bad, and he never came home. Well, this was on a Saturday. So it's on a Sunday, and we're in ICU, and he had a falling out with one of his sponsees, He had a falling out, and it was a very ugly falling out. But I, like I said, the medication was just not making him himself. And so I really worried about that, because now he's on his deathbed. And I'm worried, what happens when you have a falling out like that and you're on your deathbed? And if you go, you know, what do we do with that? You know, I was really concerned about, how is he going to make an amend? He can't make amends. He's dying. And Trish comes to the hospital because he's... I'm sleeping there, and I'm just, you know, and she comes to take me to a meeting. I'm like, a meeting, that's right, that's what we do. She comes and she takes me to a meeting. And then I'm telling her, I said, Trish, I'm really concerned because he cannot make amends to this guy who he had a falling out with, and, you know, and she says, well, pray about it. So I said, okay, so she drops me off. I go back upstairs, and there's a crowd of people outside of his room, and there's the guy who he had had that falling out with. And that guy was there to visit Lou, and he forgave Lou. And that was an answer to, you know, I'm just like, oh, my God, you know, thank you, God, thank you, God. And that took that off my plate because it was really heavy. And then I think we're there 3 days, and Sarah, you guys all know Sarah, tall cowboy Sarah, she comes to see him the second day. She says, Yolanda, I think he... You know, it took a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to tell me that he wants to be home. Never occurred to me. Of course he wants to be home. Okay, the next day we had him home. But AA, you know, told me, okay, you know, and it's just amazing. So then hospice comes in there like, he's going to die anytime. Well, 2 days go by and he's still not dead. I don't mean that disrespectfully, but, you know, you're waiting. And so... I get on the phone and I'm thinking maybe he's worried. He doesn't want to leave me. He's worried what's going to happen. I don't know. So I just get on the phone and I called another one of us and I said, you know what, could you do me a favor? Could you come and have a meeting, bring the men's stag, because that was his favorite, bring a men's stag meeting here to the house. And I really think Lou would like a meeting. And so there they were. That day at 3 o'clock, all of a sudden, I don't know how many people were there. 7, 8 people. Tom, Billy, Lee, Stan L. I mean, April was there. Sarah, Marianne. People just showed up, and we had a meeting. And we go around the room sharing, and then Lee says, okay, we're going to give Lou... a chance now. I mean, Lou's dying, but still Lou had, it was that spirit of, you know, it was just, oh, it was a beautiful thing, and I never, so we give Lou, you know, a minute or so, and then we proceed, you know, to go around, and it was just like, whew. So then the next morning at 8, he passed. But I believe he passed. You know, he passed in peace, and he knew we were okay, and, you know, and that's what AA, you know, did. And so then a year and a half later, I finally, my higher power finally, and I finally trusted the higher power that you guys, all this stuff is what it takes for me to get a relationship with my higher power. I never had this before. I didn't know this, I didn't know there was a way. I was trying to do it my way, this get together with this higher power. It just wasn't working. But here it was spelled out for me how to get that relationship. I'm like, oh my God. So then finally I said, okay, Lord, if you could help me stay sober without alcohol, I'm going to trust you on this. So I worked with my doctor, and after 16 years of taking antidepressants, I was able to wean off of them in just a few months. And so it was just like, but this was the higher power I was trusting in. This is exactly, you know, and so I was really scared because I tried before and it didn't work, and, you know, really bad experiences. But I thought, okay, I'm going to test this guy. I'm going to test him. And I don't have to take them anymore. And so now I'm getting my health back. And is that the right time? Oh my God! And you know what? It's all. Oh, there's so much I didn't say. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. I better stop now because it's late. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.